بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Sisters and brothers, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. We are here this afternoon to take a look at probably the most remarkable person in our lifetime. Of course, we don't know what the future has to uncover. The knowledge of the future is in the domain of Allah and not in our limited human earthly existence. But from all that we know up until this moment, we can say quite comfortably that the late Imam Khomeini, may Allah shower him with peace and felicity, this personality, and hindsight is always 20/20, they say. When we take a look at him now with the years that have passed, the more we do so, the more we can appreciate the magnitude and the substance with which he presented not only those who admire him, but it went beyond that to those who don't even know much about him. And obviously there are many ways to approach this unique figure that Allah has blessed us with. A part of that you have just listened to, a person, a Canadian, who went there. I think this was in the early years of the Islamic Revolution, and he described to us quite poetically and with some excellent details the atmosphere that he encountered when he met the Imam. I want to concentrate, though, on an area that I think is very, very important. And it is relevant to the, maybe we can call this, absence of his presence in making decisions today. And this has to do with the Muslim psychology itself. The Muslim psychology, and I'm talking about the general Muslim psychology, has a tendency to avoid what may be the most determinant factor that will define our common future, and for that matter, probably the future of humanity. This psychological reality or fact that I am referring to is that, and this is an area that the Imam rahmatullahi alayhi demonstrated for us how, when we are presented with the type of circumstances that I'm going to be speaking about, how we should behave or interact with these conditions. I don't think anyone who has common sense will deny the fact that Muslims have enemies. The problem is in how we behave towards the enemies that we have. And another problem is in trying to define these enemies. This is a problem that we have, but the Imam, may Allah's blessings be upon him, did not have. And this is what distinguishes him from us. Let me come down with something like a theological approach to this, or a Quranic context for this. No two Muslims are going to argue that we Muslims have enemies. In theory, we're not going to argue that. I don't think, except for a few who are lost in intoxicating themselves with a peacefulness that doesn't exist, a peacefulness that everyone wants, but in practical life is not there. Allah says to us in the Quran, إن الشيطان كان لكم عدوا فاتخذوه عدوا. Indeed, a shaitan has been or is your enemy, therefore designate him, identify him, behave towards him as if he is your enemy. But in the mythological makeup of the common Muslim mind, sometimes a shaitan is something abstract. It doesn't tend to be a practical concept for which we can factor in the daily animosities and the daily hostilities and the daily belligerencies that characterize the condition of current day Muslims, your condition and my condition. And it doesn't matter what part of the world we come from, these hostilities and belligerencies are expressed galore. There's all types of them. They range from a poisonous word and they go all the way to poisonous nuclear warheads that are being aimed towards Muslim populations. There's plenty of that, but there's a lack of identifying it. And some of this is attributed to a proportion, a hefty proportion of ignorance that has settled into the way we interpret the real world around, which was not a problem when we speak about Imam Khomeini. So we're talking here about some type of qualitative difference between our common or our public or our run-of-the-mill interpretation, assimilation, understanding, application of the meanings of the Quran with the real world around us. The fact of the matter is, as much as today, in a relative recession of the quality leadership that Al-Imam Rahmatullahi Alayhi presented us with, there are individuals who run around now, or make their rounds, be more polite about it, who make their rounds in different conferences around the world, everywhere, that want to indirectly convince us that we really don't have any enemies, and that we should seek a peaceful approach to the problems that we may encounter in life, whether it's a local problem or whether it is an international problem. We should become, as one person said, the Muslims lack Martin Luther King's and Gandhi's. So what we really need, they are telling us, they're not very blunt about it because this is communicated in so many different ways, but the end message is that we are suffering because we don't have a Gandhi and we don't have a Martin Luther King. And the retort to that is, no, we are suffering because all of us are Gandhis and all of us are Martin Luther Kings. We don't have the equivalents, and if we do, they're very rare, and they are exceptional. We don't have the equivalent of Imam al-Khomeini, who was not a Gandhi and was not a Martin Luther King. We also have this fuzzy way of avoiding the issue of enemies, hostile forces, by thinking about it strictly in historical terms. The ayah in the Quran says, اِهْبِطُوا بَعْضُكُمْ لِبَعْضٍ عَدُوٌ. Descend therefore from heaven, some of you are enemies of others. And the conventional Muslim mind tends to look at this in a historical lapse or with a historical distance. It cannot reinvigorate these meanings as if they are the human act as it is played out in the real world today, with the hostilities being expressed between different segments of the human population. Now let me say that Muslims don't go around looking for enemies. Don't misunderstand what we're trying to say here. Imam Khomeini was not going around looking for enemies. The prophets themselves did not go around looking for enemies. The way things happen, if you are on a course to Allah, on this Sirat al-Mustaqim, that we always repeat daily, اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ. If you are on that course, the way life functions, the way human beings react is they present themselves to us as enemies. And we are not excused to say, to bury our heads beneath the sand and say, no, we don't have any enemies. Allah Azza wa Jal is the enemy of the kafirs. These words are built in to our belief system, to our thoughts. فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ عَدُوٌ لِلْكَافِرِينَ. Allah is an enemy of the kafirs. If we understand these basics, we can certainly understand Imam al-Khomeini much more than a person who was just involved in the administration of the affairs of state. We can see the direction that he was moving in, and we can see how he identified those who expressed their animosity to a determination to see to it that Islam is the order of the day. The Islamic Revolution took place in Iran. The Muslims did go from Iran picking on people from different parts of the world. What happened? When the Islamic power base was established in Iran, what happened after that? War broke out. How can anyone come to anyone in their right mind and in their right senses and say that once a block of people are determined to have an Islamic codification for their life, then they're going to be left alone? If someone is thinking like that, it's more like daydreaming. It's not like facing the facts and the realities. This should be for many of us who cannot relate to issues that happened many, many centuries ago. This is a prime and a fresh example that has happened in our lifetime. It was a simple process. A population, the Muslims in Iran, decided to have an Islamic state. What's wrong with that? Why should anyone express their hostility to this Islamic state? They did. Let's skip the details of why and look at the result. They did express it, and it was a war that continued for 8 long years that drained the budgets, the potentials, the manpower of all who were involved. And it wasn't only a war between Iraq and Iran, as it is presented to be. This was a war by the status quo powers that be against this new breakthrough in that whole region. Never before has there been an Islamic power base, and now, for the first time in contemporary history, there is an Islamic power base in the area. And who was antagonized by this the most? And these are people who were tending to their own affairs. The Muslims in Iran were not in Iraq, they were not in Saudi Arabia, they were not in Lebanon, they were not in Turkey, they were in their own homes, in their own country. And this effort was led by Imam al-Khomeini, and when hostility was expressed, what did he do? Did he say, look, you know, this should be solved diplomatically? We should find a political solution to this hostility and war of aggression in which they egged on the Iraqi government, occupied a good chunk of territory of what's supposed to be a sovereign state, even by the norms and by the standards of international law. This is a sovereign state. You just can't go in there and occupy the land just because people decided in their own internal affairs to have a change of government. You can't do something like that. But the international system, the international political order ganged up on the leadership of the Imam and the power base of Islam and launched this war of aggression. Now what would happen, what would have been done? Let's say we didn't have this experience behind us. Let's say something like this just happened today. Imam Khomeini is not around. He let's assume for just a moment, he was not there. And some Muslims somewhere else, take Egypt, take Turkey, take your choice of places in the world. They decided to go Islamic. And the powers that be, the superpowers, the hyperpowers, they understood what that means. And so they instigated some of their cronies in the area to launch a war of aggression against this power base wherever you want it to be. What would be the response? How do you respond to something like this? You respond to them by quoting ayat from the Quran and wishing the occupation away? Or you respond to it by going to the international forums, to the United Nations, to the Security Council, to NATO, to the superpowers, and you plead for understanding? Is that the Islamic response to hostility? For people who are disconnected from Allah, disconnected from His Prophet, yeah, they may choose to do something like that. And they'll argue for it, and they may come up with fancy words to defend their positions. But it has no basis in the Quran, and it has no basis in the precedent of the Prophet. What made the leadership of Imam Khomeini, what makes it unique, is that it was forcefully embedded in the depths of the understanding of the Quran and the Prophet. And so he didn't. Why do we say this? Allah in the ayat in the Quran says, وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَهُمُ الْبَغْيُ هُمْ يَنْتَصِرُونَ. And those who suffer the consequences of aggression, They opt for triumph, for counterforce to achieve this triumph. And Allah says, وَجَزَاءُ سَيِّئَةٍ سَيِّئَةٌ مِثْلُهَا. And to counter effect a sayyi'ah, you instigate a counter sayyi'ah. War is a sayyi'ah. Aggression is a sayyi'ah. And to annul it, you get involved in it. And he says, وَإِنْ عَاقَبْتُمْ فَعَاقِبُوا بِمِثْلِ مَا عُوقِبْتُمْ بِهِ. And if you mete out punishment, you do it in the quality and quantity of the punishment that comes your way. If war is imposed on you, then you launch a counter war to equalize it. And there are other ayat in the Quran that leave no choice for us to try to contrive political arguments to cover our weakness. Al-Imam al-Khomeini did not have this psychological weakness. But this is what some of the other individuals who are around making decisions or trying to make decisions in other lands, in other areas, especially as it pertains to the Palestinian problem that we all have, which threads together not only a contemporary war of hostility against the Muslims, but it brings with it all the historical weight to bear against us. Allah says, وَلَا يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَتَّخِذُوا عَدُوِّي وَعَدُوَّكُمْ أَوْلِيَاءَ. O you who are securely committed to Allah, don't have my enemy and your enemy as a source of allegiance, alliance, or authority. We don't have this quality of leaders that are making decisions for all the Muslims in today's world. You can't say that this psychological, healthy understanding of what Allah is saying and what men are doing, who can come out with confidence and say that aggression and warfare has to be dealt with by counter-aggression and by counter-warfare. Is there an issue that all Muslims agree upon more than the what is called the Israeli-Palestinian issue? Have you ever encountered any serious disputes among Muslims as to whether the Israeli nation state is an enemy of Muslims? I think it's almost a universal given, a universal common agreement among all Muslims that the Israeli Zionist nation state is the number one enemy of all the Muslims in the world. And there shouldn't be anyone surprised by this. لَتَجِدَنَّ أَشَدَّ النَّاسِ عَدَاوَةً لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا الْيَهُودَ وَالَّذِينَ أَشْرَكُوا. You will find those who express the utmost hostility and belligerency towards those who are committed to Allah to be اليهود and الذين أشركوا. This is, Israel is an interpretation, the Israeli nation state, with criminals as leaders, is expressing this hostility that no one should disagree about. But even though we all agree on this issue, How do you deal with it? How do you deal with an enemy? We've seen some attempts. Remember Sadat? Some of you are old enough to recall the chapters of how he capitulated to the Zionist occupation and theft of the Holy Land. Did it work? We don't have to recreate the needle all over again. We've seen, all of us have seen what has happened to the policies of the Egyptian government. Where have they gone? Has the Egyptian people experienced a betterment in their living? Have they gone down the right track? And those who are supportive of the Egyptian government in its surrender to the Israeli nation state, such as the Saudi Arabian government, who is behind the curtains bankrolling these policies. What has come of them? More humiliation, more occupation, more attacks on innocent people, and now the most likely turn of events. The Israelis now are planning, I don't think it's a wild guess any longer, as it may have been 8 or 9 years ago when we began saying these words. The Israeli government right now is trying to dislocate a whole population. It wants to move in mass the Palestinians from the occupied territories east of the Jordan River. They can go wherever they want to go, as long as they leave into Jordan or Iraq or wherever, they can do that, but they no longer, according to Israeli and American official policies, they are no longer wanted in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now let us look at the past. Before we look at the past years, let me quote for you some of what Al-Imam Al-Khomeini said many years ago. Someone asked him, amongst your demands is the annihilation of the state of Israel. If this leads to Israel's destruction and victory for the Palestinians, what will be the fate of the Jews? That was a question that someone came and asked the late Imam. And he said, the issue of the Jews is quite separate from that of the Zionists. If the Muslims are victorious over the Zionists, the latter will meet the same fate as the deposed Shah. However, the Muslims will do nothing to the Jews, for they are a nation like other nations. They will carry on with their lives and they will not suffer dispossession. What the Imam is speaking about here is, if you see, we are always sidetracked, we meaning the Muslims or the Arabs or the Palestinians, or we are always sidetracked into the way the Israelis present the annihilation of the state of Israel. They go on to say, look, the Muslims want to dump the Jews into the sea, or the Muslims want to destroy the Jewish state. Number one, I don't think any responsible Muslim has said, we are going to dump the Jews into the sea. And defy, anytime this is brought to your attention, defy anyone who is telling you that to present proof of what they are saying. And number two, Muslims don't want to destroy a Jewish state because Israel is not a Jewish state. Israel is a Zionist state. And Muslims want to dismantle and deconstruct and terminate an Israeli Zionist racist apartheid enclave in the Holy Land. This appears clear from the statements that Imam Khomeini gave, all of them pertaining to the malignant Israeli nation-state that has been enforced on the peoples of that part of the world. But how do we do this if we encounter a general Muslim psychology that is not prepared to identify an enemy and then take corrective measures against that enemy, which will mean warfare and combatant duties? How do you do something like that? You begin to educate the Muslims. Are we going to liberate Palestine by giving out PhDs on the issue of how Palestine was stolen from its rightful occupants? Is this the way to liberating Palestine? Or is the way to liberating Palestine begging the United Nations for resolutions? The United Nations has issued scores of resolutions and condemnations of the Israeli nation state, telling it it has to withdraw to the borders of 1967, or it has to withdraw from the occupied areas of southern Lebanon, or it has to do this, that, and the other, and it hasn't done any of that. The Israeli nation state junked all of these resolutions, threw them in file number 13, in the trash can. Let us take the Egyptian government and its sponsorship of the Palestinian Authority. Every time Mr. Arafat wanted to embark on a particular local policy in the West Bank or in Gaza, he'd go to Cairo and consult with the Egyptian president or the Egyptian government. They more or less micromanaged in Egypt on behalf of the United States and the Israelis, the Palestinian Authority. Where did that get them? Virtually nowhere. Actually, it caused them to lose ground. They went from having a moral high ground to having now virtually no ground at all in this issue. Now juxtapose that with the Islamic leadership in Iran and how its relationship with the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, which identified this area of a pronounced belligerency and warfare by the Israeli Zionists against the occupants of southern Lebanon. How did they deal with this? Did the chairman of Hezbollah shuttle all around the area and all around the world asking for understanding the Palestinian issue? No. What they did was they consolidated their rank and file, they identified and designated the enemy, and then they countered enemy aggression with force. And what happened? For the first time, since 1948, the Israeli offensive forces were defeated in southern Lebanon and had to retreat, humiliated, from territories that they wanted to hold on to, calling it their security zone. There's a difference here. If we wanted to take a look at these two parallel policies throughout the years, the relationship between the Islamic resistance in Lebanon and the Islamic State in Iran, and the relationship between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza and the Egyptian, what do we want to call it? If we use the appropriate word, some people say Well, you loaded your terminology. The client regime, the Egyptian client regime, what happened? No results. No results. Not to speak of counter or opposite results. An Imam, may Allah rest his soul in peace, spoke about the Palestinian issue early, way before the Islamic Revolution in 1978 and 1979. Let me quote for you a statement that he made back on February 6th, 1971. This was a message that he sent to the pilgrims in Mecca. In 1971, he sent a message to the pilgrims in Mecca. In it, he said, "Unite and cooperate for the sake of independence and the elimination of the cancer of imperialism. Listen to the people of each Muslim land explain their problems, and then neglect no measure necessary for the solution of these problems. Consider the poor and needy in the Islamic lands. Turn your attention to the liberation of the Islamic land of Palestine from the grasp of Zionism, the enemy of Islam and humanity. Do not hesitate to assist and cooperate with those heroic men who are struggling to liberate Palestine." Of course, this is only one paragraph from a long message that was sent and read to the Hujjaj, to the pilgrims in Mecca. And a result of that, what happened? In 1971, we're not talking about an Islamic revolution that rattled the brains of reactionaries. There was no Islamic revolution around. And what happened, just because a few volunteers of the Imam at the time, I think was in Najaf, who read this message in Mecca, they were taken, and iron was put around, ironclads or iron chains or whatever you want to call them, put around their feet. And they stayed in detention, I don't know, months or a couple of years. Can't remember the duration time at this moment, but it was an extended time of period. And it took the interference of, at the time, of the Saudi ambassador in Tehran to speak to his government to release these people. And now what do we have? We have some politicians from the same land of the Haramain who are willing to recognize this tragedy of history that occupies the Holy Land. It's not new. The proposals that were made a few months ago, they're not new. They were made back in 1982 at the Fez conference in Morocco by the same ailing person right now who was passing away and can no longer rule the kingdom. Nothing new. This is what makes men great. This is the difference between Imam al-Khomeini, may Allah rest his soul in eternal peace, and the nitwits that go around and try to surrender to Allah's enemies. Because in themselves, they never imagined, they never took a moment to pause and say, do we really have enemies? They don't want to deal with that. Psychologically, they run away from it. So if on that level they're not dealing with it, obviously their policies and their statements and their actions and their diplomatic behavior, all of this is going to reflect it. And this is what we have in the true world. And so what's going to happen? They're going to attack us? We're being attacked. They're going to drop bombs. They're already dropping bombs on us. They're going to render us refugees. They're already rendering us refugees. You know, when the Iraqis were attacking with missiles and trying to threaten, they're going to do this, that, and the other, any man was calm. What's all of this about? Why is everyone getting nervous? This is the feeling you get when you are at a close distance with Allah. There's nothing to be tense about. What is it? If the worst thing in this world that could happen if you are fighting and defending your rights is we're going to die. And so what? We go on to a better life. What's the nervousness and the tension and all of this about? Why are people afraid? Which I think leads us to what I would say the standoff in history. We are fortunate enough, I think, to be living at a time when history is at a moment in which its forces now are confronting each other. What do I mean by this? There's an interchange of role between Muslims and Jews. And I use the word Muslims and Jews here, not in the very technical sense. I just use it in the very general sense. Because the position that we are in today, we meaning the Muslims, is not new. Other peoples at other times in other societies, deep down in the chapters of history, they were where we are today. And what characterizes our predicament today is that we feel we are powerless. This is the main trait that runs through our minds and through our psyches. We feel and we think we are powerless. Now, of course, there are some exceptions to this rule, but let's jump beyond the exceptions. Let's look at the totality of this affair. And this is the same way that the Israelis or the Jews felt at one time in their history. They've been here where we are. They've experienced the same thing. And pertaining to what? Pertaining to the Holy Land. Allah told them at one time, "Udkhulu al-ardha al-muqaddasata allati kataba Allahu lakum wa la tartaddu ala adbarikum fatanqalibu khasirin." Enter this ayah goes something like this. Enter the Holy Land that Allah has designated for you. And don't retreat in making that thrust into the Holy Land, because if you do, you'll wind up losing. Okay, this is what Allah is telling them to do. But what are the facts on the ground? They looked, these Israelis who were in the position that we are in today, feeling powerless, feeling hopeless, they said, "Inna fiha qawman jabbarin." But indeed in that land there is something like a superpower. An ominous people. Now, if this statement doesn't describe the way many of us think, I don't know what does. Because now, if you come to the average Muslim and you tell him, look, this is what we have to do. We know we don't have F-16s. We know we don't have nuclear weapons. We know we don't have these satellites. You know, the Israelis, they put this Ofek system of satellites above the region in the Middle East, Ofek 1 and 2, and Ufuk, you know, horizon, it means horizon. So they have these satellites up there on the horizon. We just don't compare to the military might and power and base that this regional superpower has. So what are we going to do? We can't fight against them. That's what they'll tell you. We can't fight against them. We don't stand a chance. Now, this was said before, when people were put into this position before us, who are also recipients of scripture and revelation, just like all of us. We say we have the Quran and we have the Prophet and we really have guidance and we know what it's all about. Well, they did the same, they had the same thing. But when they were put in this particular position, then they showed their true colors. None of that vouched for them. All the scripture, all the prayers, all the namaz, all the fasting, all the voluntary good things that they were doing all around, when it came time to prove themselves, meaning to fight, to realize this is God's given responsibility, and you have to dislodge those people who are erroneous and don't belong there, and then you look at the balance of power and you realize, hey, wait a minute, if we do something like this, it's going to be a suicidal war. Now, if we would have said suicide last year or a couple of years ago, it wouldn't have had the same connotations as it has today. Because now they're scaring us. Look, the last thing these Muslims are doing is they're going on suicide missions. And this is the crux of the matter. This is where we have come to face our historical self. Because, and this is where some of us lose sight, the previous experience that happened when the Israelis said, we're not going to go in there, was our historical failure. Because there's no delineation between the followers of prophets and the history of scripture that we inherited. All of this comes together. So it's enough that there was a failure at that time. There shouldn't be a failure at this time. But the Israelis in Jewish history broke away from that failure. And they began to work on accumulating as much power as they can to make a comeback to the Holy Land, which they did. They successfully, albeit temporarily, made a triumphant military comeback and occupied the land that they could not take through what they perceived at the time as suicidal military attack against that superpower. They took another route and they're back. And in the process, they placed us where they were. I hope I didn't lose anyone here. So what are we going to say here when we are in this position? Wait a minute. These are suicide missions. These are suicide operations. Are we going to act like those Israelis did many hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago and do the same thing? Or are we going to prove that we are capable of delivering when Allah expects us to do so? This is the challenge that an imam saw. And this is what he was pointing to. And this is what he expected us to do. And some of us have remained loyal to the imam and are carrying that struggle until its bitter end. This is what Hezbollah, this is what the Islamic resistance, and on the way Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the rest of the Muslims are going to find themselves responsible for. And this is the only way, this is the way we prove our mettle. We have to take this responsibility, not dodge it with diplomacy, not try to create excuses of running away from it. It doesn't work that way. Because if we do that, then we exclude ourselves, we discredit ourselves. And if we do go that far, Allah says, وَإِن تَتَوَلَّوْا يَسْتَبِدِلْ قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَكُونُوا أَمْثَالَكُمْ. And if you retreat, Allah will replace you with a people who will not duplicate this type of behavior that you have shown. And why do you think that the Israelis are squirming? They're trying their utmost best with everything they have to put an end to this Islamic reinvigoration that was launched by the late Imam. There are people who are still true and faithful to this direction of the Imam. And you will know them by this context that we are talking about. And for all of those who are nationalistically or sectarian or whatever they are deep down inside, all of this will surface. All of this will come to the fore. And those who are on this line, in this direction, they will prove themselves. Just give them time. And they will show us that Allah will grant victory. Where do we expect this victory? Where do these people, we're talking about a few hundred, several hundred Hezbollahis in South Lebanon, where do they get victory from? They have some kind of line of weapons that was coming to them from some superpower somewhere? Did they rely on military technology? None of that. They went ahead, they assumed their responsibilities, they countered first they identified the enemy, they designated the enemy as the enemy, and then they communicated with the enemy in the language that the enemy understands, and that is why they are where they are today, successful. They didn't go all of these other routes, because they lead nowhere. And that's why this concept of a shahada, or martyrdom, was not lost in the throes and in the gestation of history. It was maintained especially by the types of Muslims that come from the land of the Imam, who know what this meaning of shahada is. And this terrifies the Israelis. Oh, no, no, no. Why can't you become like everyone else? And some have fallen along the way. We've seen the course of the past 20 years. Imam has been gone for, what, 13 years? In the course of these years, we've seen some people who are beginning to show some type of fatigue, as if it is ideological inertia by some individuals here and there, or even segments of people here and there. Well, that's what it is. That's what you have been all along. This doesn't require that. This requires a confidence in the line of the Imam which he defined and he set. And whether all problems may be solved, but this problem is not going to be solved by any other means except for the Muslims. I think in one statement the Imam said, if only every Muslim took a bucket of water and threw it on Palestine, the problem would be washed away. So why is this inertia? Why? I can't understand where this comes from. There are some diplomats, they wanted to get involved in diplomatic flurries here and there and do some things and convince themselves, okay, you can try that. They've been trying it for years. But parallel to that, there were others who took the line that, look, you know, this problem, this Israeli problem, and this may have unexpected benefits. You saw, we all saw, when the war was imposed on the Islamic State in Iran by its neighboring country, and supported by the political system in the area and the international system for that matter. We saw how Muslims were polarized. Some Muslims are saying, no, this is not the right way to go. You should reach an accommodation, put an end to this war. Look, the Iraqis are willing to sue for peace. Let us terminate this, etc., etc., etc. We all lived through that. Okay, now, because we all Muslims and justice-seeking people around the world, you don't have to be a Muslim to see the validity of what is called the Palestinian issue. If we concentrate on the liberation of Palestine, because the Israeli government belongs to the political system in the area, when pressure is placed on it, the other weaker governments are going to give in. We may not intend that. Our thrust is against the Israeli usurpation and occupation of the Holy Land. But in that thrust, the lesser ones may begin to cave in. And let it happen. So what? If this is Allah's will, we welcome these types of positive developments along this direction. But without that, changes are hard to come by. And you can see, some people ask, why are the Americans, the American government and the military and all of this, why are they in Afghanistan at this time? Well, this is a long question that has a long answer. But to sum up, the reason for it being in that area is to set back Islamic self-determination for many years to come. They want to rid Muslims of nuclear weapons. They want to steal Muslim resources in Central Asia. And then they want to surround the Islamic power base in Iran. And the surrounding the Islamic State in Iran is their number one priority, because they know the potential. And that's why they're saying, they're trying to put pressure on the Islamic resistance in Iran through roundabout ways, through channels in Tehran, tell them to cool their heels. Don't persist in this resistance. And I think the Imam, may Allah bless him, I think the Imam could foresee that if Muslims are not as determined in the military sense of the word to take on the cancerous Israeli presence in the Middle East, then we may have a repeat. Remember when, after World War I, the European powers, the French and the British, went into that same part of the world, Palestine and Lebanon and Syria and Iraq. And the French general, one of these French generals, went up to the grave or the mausoleum of Salah ad-Din, who had liberated Palestine 900 years ago. He went up to him in his grave and he kicked that grave. And he said, now the Crusades have come to an end. It is now that the Crusades have come to an end. Why? Well, obviously, when you have ideas that jihad is not a basic component of Islam, a shahada is not a central feature, martyrdom is not a central feature of Islam, al-qital is not a concept in Islam. When you have this type of demilitarization of the Muslims, this is what happens. Al-Imam stood for the militarization of the Muslims at at a time when it is needed more than any other time. This is the time when we have to think about carrying arms. And no one's going to blame us. I mean, look, military bases in the world are in our lands. International, multinational, transnational corporations are stealing our resources. We don't have fair and free elections throughout Asia and Africa. So why can't we have self-determination? You can tell this to anyone with common sense in their head. They'll tell you, yeah, you Muslims, you have that right. Go ahead and have self-determination. Especially when we deal with this Israeli menace that is unidentifiable. How do you define this Israel? It keeps on changing its borders. Israel in the late 40s is not Israel in the late 60s, is not Israel in the beginning of the 80s, is not Israel today. It keeps on fluctuating itself. An Israel that doesn't have a constitution. An Israel that doesn't have permanent citizenry. Since the outbreak of the Intifada, what was it? 19 months ago? 20 months? Since the outbreak of that Intifada, it is estimated around 1.5 million of these Israelis left Israel. That is 1/3 of the so-called Jewish population that make up the manpower of the Israeli nation state, left the country altogether. Where have we heard of something like this? A state at war and 1/3 of its population leaves? Can you bring me one example in history when something like that occurs? Its finances are going down. Its tourism industry that brings in $2.4 billion a year hasn't brought anything in the past year to speak about. Banks now are reflecting losses, liabilities, and they had to instigate a new economic program that caused one of the major religious parties to threaten to leave the Knesset, and it left, and it came back a couple of days later begging to re-enter. Can we say that they're not in turmoil? The complaints that they have individually towards the war criminal that heads their state, a war criminal that is systematically involved in massacres, Qibya in the early 40s, and then Sabra and Shatila, and now Jenin, and the massacre of Egyptian prisoners of war in the Sinai. إِن كُنْتُمْ تَأْلَمُونَ فَإِنَّهُمْ يَأْلَمُونَ كَمَا تَأْلَمُونَ وَتَرْجُونَ مِنَ اللَّهِ مَا لَا يَرْجُونَ. If we are hurting, they are hurting like we are. But we have this confidence and we have this hope in Allah which they don't have. They want life because we want shahada. But we have to continue at this. This doesn't come from Muslims who are sitting on the fence and watching all of this. We have to be involved. So the demilitarization of the Muslims made it possible for Ayyimbi to come back, a European general, to the Holy Land and tell a commander who defeated them hundreds of years ago, now the Crusaders have come to an end. And if we continue to be demilitarized along diplomatic and political lines, the way the opponents of the line of the Imam in the region, beginning with the land of the Haramain, are trying to take the Muslims, if we continue, then don't be surprised if an Israeli general, or even if Sharon himself, goes to Al-Madina in Hijaz, and he stands, just like Ayyimbi stood next to the grave of Salah ad-Din, he stands next to the grave of the Prophet, and he kicks it with his foot, and he says, now Ghazwat Khaybar has ended. The Imam, may Allah bless his soul, and I can't say this enough, has referred to the nature of the Zionist regime, and I have pages here, but I choose not at this moment to quote any of this for the factor of this the time limitations that we have. But what I want to say as a concluding remark, what I want to say is that, you know, it's going to be a matter of an hour or two, and you're going to go back to your regular places, I don't know, to your homes or to visit a friend or whatever. We're going to all go back to our worlds. And this is going to be just, you know, some other presentation that was given on the occasion of the passing away of the late Imam. And I think, I'm no one to speak for Imam Khomeini, qaddasallahu sirrah, but if he was here, I think the most appropriate communication from reading and understanding his thoughts on this matter is that, look, if you Muslims, if we Muslims cannot at this moment comprehend the necessity of dealing with the immediate belligerents that we have, and if we can identify a common enemy, let us unite our forces against this common enemy. I mentioned yesterday that in the United States, some of these Islamic spokespersons, personalities that have been pursuing in the past decade and a half a line of getting Muslims involved, seeking justice from the White House. These have come now, after all of these years, to realize, and I communicate to you these words because they were communicated to me person to person, didn't come from third parties. They have realized that all that they did in the past decade and a half have gotten them nowhere. And they sort of regret it, but cannot say it out loud. They can't say it to the public. Some of them may have some excuses, and some of them may be forgiven. Only Allah knows that part. But as far as those who have been more intimately involved with the Islamic Revolution, with the teachings and the advice that came from the Imam, in the past several years, even they have been swept by this tide. Not all of them, some of them have been swept by this tide. And what should we do? Wait another decade and a half for them to come out also and say, look, you know, we spent these years in vain. Nothing has been accomplished trying to pursue justice from the Pharaoh's castle. Let us at least check our tendencies and not fall into this regrettable line of action and then years later regret it. May Allah bless al-Imam al-Khomeini. May Allah strengthen the line that is represented by al-Imam al-Khamenei towards the ends that have been expressed in this presentation that was quoted, in which we quoted the Imam's saying on the liberation of Palestine. And we don't for one moment forget the shuhada that have preceded us on the fronts of the internal enemy and on the front the external enemy. ولا عدوان إلا على الظالمين. And no aggression is due, and no offense is due, except against those who have aggressed and offended. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Thank you very much.